Oh, get ready for the next couple hours. Colin Dickey joins us as we talk about his latest work, The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and our obsession with the unexplained. That's what's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest, Colin Dickey, with us. His latest book is called The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Let me tell you a little bit about Colin. Grew up in San Jose, California, a few miles away from the Winchester Mystery House. That's one of the most haunted houses in America. We'll talk a little bit about that. As a writer, speaker, and academic, he has made a career out of collecting unusual objects and hidden histories from all over the country. He's a regular contributor to the LA Review of Books, co-editor with Joanna Ebenstein of the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. He is also a member of the Order of the Good Death, which is a collection of artists, writers, and death industry professionals interested in improving the Western world's relationship with mortality. He's got a PhD in comparative literature from the University of Southern California, also an associate professor of creative writing at National University. Colin, welcome back. You were on with our colleague Dave Schrader a few years ago. It's good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
And I'm looking forward to this latest book, The Unidentified. That sounds great. Tell me a little bit about the Winchester Mystery House. What makes it so haunted, in your opinion?
Oh, yeah, the Winchester Mystery House. So for people who don't know, Sarah Winchester was the daughter-in-law of the guy who invented the Winchester Rifle Company, and her infant child and then subsequently her husband died at a young age, and so she inherited this vast sum of money, and she... according to legend, she became convinced she was her family was cursed, and a psychic told her that the thing to do would be to buy a house that was never finished. So she bought this 8-room farmhouse in San Jose, California, and started building on it, supposedly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of her life. And so the Winchester Mystery House, which, you know, you can still go visit, still sort of in the heart of... Well, actually, I don't know if tours are going on right now, but theoretically, you can visit. You know, it's this 161-room sprawling Victorian mansion that just kind of, you know, it just oozes out in every direction. It's one of the weirdest, coolest houses. And yeah, I grew up down the road from it. I used to go there all the time as a kid. It really kind of piqued my interest in these kind of weird spaces and these kind of... forgotten destinations that we don't pay too much attention to.
What is it, Colin, about people who love to go to scary places? They just love it. And as you say in the last part of your book title, our obsession with the unexplained.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like for a lot of us, it's just this desire to believe that there's just something more out there. You know, there's something that's just not quite explained by, you know, science or religion or what have you, the kind of stuff that falls between the cracks. It's just, you know, like it's all out there. It's all around us. We don't have a good explanation for it, so we kind of keep coming back. It's kind of like that itch you just kind of can't quite get to, and you keep wanting to scratch it. And I think it just kind of draws us these kind of weird things.
And of course, tell me about the Morbid Anatomy Anthology. What the heck is that?
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's a project. You know, my friend Joanna started that I became involved in, and I think it's really just. You know, again, I mean, we tend to think of this stuff as kind of gross, you know, the kind of history, kind of weird medicine and, you know, kind of pathology and stuff like that. But it also has this kind of interesting aesthetic and it's kind of beautiful at times. And so, you know, Joanna's been really involved in kind of making that kind of historical inquiry into the history of medicine and other kind of weird stuff, kind of her bailiwick. So her and I put together this book that's just sort of a collection of writers kind of tackling, you know, that kind of, you know, historical fascination with medical oddities and stuff like that. So that was a lot of fun.
And where do people get the Unidentified?
It's out. It's out as of today. So by the time you
great timing.
It's anywhere, Amazon, bookshop.org, anywhere you guys buy books. Yeah, it should be there.
You focus a lot on cryptids, UFOs, lost continents of Atlantis and Lemuria. Tell me about that connection.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I started looking at this stuff kind of, you know, even less like, is it real so much as like, what, you know, when did we get interested in this? Why did we become interested in this stuff? And it all seemed to coalesce around like the right around the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. You know, the Atlantis. I mean, you know, you got Plato talking about Atlantis, in ancient Greece, but everybody kind of forgets about it until this guy, Ignatius Donnelly, in the 1870s, publishes this book on it, and that kind of reignites our sudden newfound obsession in Atlantis, and which continues to last to this day. I think what I started to see when I kind of tried to figure out the kind of historical connection is the second half of the 19th century into the 20th century, that's really when we start to see science and religion kind of polarize into kind of two different ways of looking at the world, these kind of two separate camps, right? And they both have all these answers, right? Both, science and religion kind of, say, we've got all the answers, just, trust us. And meanwhile, there's all this stuff that kind of doesn't get kind of answered by either of them. And I think that's when we kind of start to look for what's going on here. So people who are, starting to look for cryptids, for, Bigfoot and Chupacabra and all that stuff, they were interested, we became interested in this stuff right around the time that, science and religion kind of pretended like they could answer all these questions, and we were left with this kind of weird remainder. And that seemed to be the kind of connecting thread through a lot of the stuff that ended up kind of informing what this book became about.
Have you seen some of the latest videos that the Pentagon has acknowledged now about these UFOs that the Navy fighter jets chased?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, and there, there's... reports that the Pentagon was paying, I think they paid like $20 million to some contractor to figure out if there's anything to these videos, which to me is either like, if it's a hoax, then man, that was a waste of money. And if it's real, then man, that's not nearly enough money. I mean, this is the biggest discovery ever. We should be putting a little bit more money into it. So it's a weird number. So yeah, who knows? I mean, I guess we're going to see more, but stay tuned, I guess.
Colin, what got you interested in the unusual?
I think that I've always been interested in that stuff that kind of nobody else wants to touch. My first book was this was a long time ago, but it ended up being a lot about phrenology, which is the science of the bumps on your head and whether or not they indicate your personality. And I thought, well, this is not very good science, but it did really have an impact on the 19th century. It did have an impact on history, and Walt Whitman was a big believer in phrenology. And I realized that just because something is a little strange or off-ball, a little goofball, doesn't mean that it doesn't motivate people to do things and change the world that we live in. So I think I got interested in this stuff because it seems like we should be taking this stuff seriously if it affects our world.
We're going to talk about three individuals from the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, that you key on the first part of your book. Let's start with Ignatius Donnelly. Who was Ignatius Donnelly?
So, yeah, Ignatius Donnelly, one of my favorite guys. He's sort of a failed real estate developer who then goes into Congress. He serves a couple of years in the U.S. Congress in the 1870s, and then his political fortunes change, and he's left out. So he decides what he's going to do is he's going to write a book on the history of Atlantis, which Plato notwithstanding, he's kind of the first guy in modern times to really kind of take this seriously. And he writes this book. It's a huge bestseller. People are just really, really anxious for this. It's around the time, this is, right around the time when kind of the Western world has kind of figured out pretty much everything, where everything goes on the map. The explorers have pretty much been everywhere. They have kind of filled in the spaces of the map. There's nothing really left to, quote unquote, discover, right? And so when Ignatius Donnelly comes along during this time and he's like, well, maybe there's a whole another continent, and we'll never get there. It kind of triggers that love and obsession and that fascination with kind of those undiscovered places. And so that's his that's his big kind of contribution. He ends up writing a 1,000-page book about how Shakespeare didn't write the plays attributed to him that doesn't go over quite so well, but that's the kind of guy he was.
Was he respected during his lifetime?
Oh yeah. I mean, he was he as I said, I mean he was a big bestseller. He got got letters from, you know, people like Charles Darwin who are like, well, you know, I don't know that I believe everything, but I think this is a cool idea, and I think you've done good work here. And so, yeah, so he had a pretty far and wide impact. You know, he kind of, in his later life, he could never really replicate that success, and I think he got a little embittered in his later life, but he definitely had his moment to shine, and I mean, we're still talking about Atlantis, and I think that's thanks to our good friend Ignatius.
A name we've heard before, Madame Blavatsky. Tell us about her.
Yeah, and so sort of around the same time, you know, she's pioneering this, you know, this idea of, you know, what becomes theosophy. But she also takes the idea of Atlantis, and then she takes this other idea, Lemuria, which was originally an idea that, you know, maybe there's a continent between Madagascar and India where, you know, which explains why there are lemurs on both of those places. And it sunk a long time ago, and you know, thus the name Lemuria. So she, you know, the geologists kind of lose interest in that idea. It kind of doesn't quite work for them, but she picks it up, and she really runs with this idea that, you know, if Atlantis can be somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, maybe there's a Pacific Ocean corollary, Lemuria. And so, you know, like, once again, you know, we're sort of looking for kind of new and undiscovered lands, and you know, unlike Ignatius, Blavatsky adds a lot more of a kind of metaphysical dimension. You know, this idea that, like, different descendants, or, you know, kind of different evolutions of human beings existed on these various sunken continents, and the Lemurians were slightly advanced from, you know, you and I or whatever, and, you know, they, and so, you know, so that again, this idea that, you know, it's not just a lost continent, but it's a lost continent with these kind of semi-magical or semi-advanced or, you know, creatures kind of floating around. Maybe they're human, maybe they're not, you know, and that then becomes, you know, what people now, you know, talk about in terms of, you know, maybe the Sasquatch, maybe that's like a different kind of moment of evolution in human beings or something like that. You know, I don't know. Like, I find different theories all over the place.
One of my favorites at the time, Charles Fort, creator of the Fortean Times. Tell us about him.
Yeah, and again, I mean, Charles Fort, you know, who's a huge influence on this book, and I imagine for a lot of your listeners. And the difference between Charles Fort, the reason why I think just Charles Fort is so great is that, you know, he, unlike Blavatsky and Lemuria, or Ignatius Donnelly, like, he doesn't necessarily put forth a thesis. You know, that's what's really great about those books, is he just sort of, like, he lists all this crazy stuff.
He just lays it out there, doesn't he?
Exactly, yeah. He just kind of puts it out there, and he says, you know, science doesn't have a good answer for this. I don't have a good answer for this, but it looks like it happened. So go do with that what you will. You know, I mean, the idea of, you know, the Book of the Damned, you know, which is what his first book is called, the idea that these are damned facts. These are facts that are kind of cursed and driven out of the respectable halls of science. That to me is a really cool idea. And so what I try to do in this book is best I could kind of follow kind of Charles Fort's model by, you know, kind of, you know, reporting and kind of trying to trace this stuff without necessarily feeling like I needed a strong scientific answer for why everything happened.
Colin, how different was Charles Fort from Ripley? They were around the same time period. And Ripley, of course, finding oddities and little crazy things, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's part of a whole movement. I mean, I think that Ford is really the originator of that kind of inquiry because, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners know this, but he starts out writing books closer to, you know, Donnelly's book in Atlantis. He has this book about, you know, maybe human behavior is controlled by, like, radio waves through the planet Venus or something like that, but he can't find a publisher for it, and it never gets published, and he burned the manuscript. We don't have it anymore. We have no idea what was in it, but you know, this idea, you know, so he starts with this idea, like, well, I've got this kind of crazy thesis, but what he actually ends up, you know, being well known for is the opposite, for sort of resisting putting his own ideas in there and just sort of collecting the facts and collecting these reports.
On March 3rd, 1876, large hunks of flesh fell from the sky over Olympia Springs in Bath County, Kentucky. We didn't have airplanes then. What the heck was going on in 1876?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to research was the Great Kentucky Meat Shower. And right, we have these reports. We have this this woman and her granddaughter were out outside, and these just this meat starts falling from the sky, and they collected it up in jars. But
was it human flesh?
So we don't exactly know for sure. There was some analysis that said that it was the closest thing was either horse or human baby.
Oh, but, God.
Yeah, I know. It's really gross. My favorite story, the New York Herald sends a reporter out, and he gets a chunk of this stuff, and he tries to pay an Irish laborer, quote-unquote Irish laborer, that's how he describes him, to eat it. And so he gets this laborer guy, and he's like, I'll pay you to eat this meat. And the guy's like, okay, sure. He gets it on his plate in front of him, and he's like, I really need something to wash it down. So the reporter gets him some whiskey. So, make it a little easier. And, and then the laborer is like, can I get some vegetables too? And he, gets them some sides. And then finally the laborer just says, I just remembered that it's Lent. I can't eat meat. And he takes off.
Smart guy. Was it fresh, Colin?
It appeared to be fresh. It's still not. I mean, there are lots of theories about what it was, but, I don't know that I buy necessarily any of them, So what? Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, and regardless of what it was, how did it come down from the skies? I mean, I don't get it. I mean, you're not flying. You can't drop it from a plane. There is no plane. What? How did that happen?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the best quote unquote theories is that it was a pack of vultures who were flying overhead and vomited, but
and they decided they didn't want it.
Yeah, exactly. They were eating a horse somewhere. Maybe the meat had turned.
That might make sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, but there were no reports of giant packs of flying vultures. So it sort of makes sense, but it's not perfect. I don't know.
What if a UFO gobbled up some people? Did whatever they did to them, and then dumped them.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. I mean,
you can't rule it out.
Yeah. I heard one theory that maybe they were firing like smallpox tainted meat out of a cannon or something like that. But that doesn't exactly hold a whole lot of water.
What did you do with the University of Transylvania?
So I'm trying to figure out. I go out to Bath Springs, Kentucky, where this supposedly happened. Of course, there's not really any traces of it. And then I find out that there is actually, in a jar in the University of Transylvania, supposedly a remaining piece of this meat. So I go to the...
From 1876, it's still there?
Yeah. This museum on the University of Transylvania campus called the Monroe Musnick Museum, which they've collected up all these really bizarre kind of historical oddities and medical oddities that the university has stockpiled. It's a really old university. And they have a jar, and it says, kind of an old faded script. It says Olympia Springs, and in it is this kind of, alcohol substance, and inside the alcohol substance is this thing. It's really gross. Look at it. It's all kind of white and bloated. It doesn't, if you're thinking it's going to look like meat, it doesn't look like meat. It looks like, it looks kind of just like this old bloated white knobby bit of organic matter,
bizarre.
And that supposedly is the last remaining evidence of the Kentucky meat shower. So I went to the University of Transylvania to take a look at that stuff.
We're going to come back in a moment with Colin Dickey and talk more about his work, The Unidentified. His website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Just an amazing book. And when we come back, we'll talk more about some very strange things. How about a sea serpent? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Colin Dickey, the unidentified mythical monsters, alien encounters, and our obsession with the unexplained. We really are obsessed with the unexplained, though, Colin, aren't we?
I mean, yeah, I think that we always are trying to find answers for things, but I think we also secretly want to make sure that there's always going to be something that we don't have answers for. I mean, I think that if we instantly knew exactly what all this stuff was about, if we had answers for all this stuff, it was all just made clear for us. I mean, that'd be kind of a boring world, don't you think?
I think so. Tell us about the Gloucester Sea Serpent.
I love the Gloucester Sea Serpent, and it's like, you know, I think that Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, they get all the press. But you know, those guys, you know, love them as much as I do. I mean, it's always like one person, you know, like, or, you know, a couple hikers, or, you know, one grainy photograph, you know. Meanwhile, the Gloucester Sea Serpent, so this is something that, like, literally hundreds of people saw. This was in 1820 in Cape Ann, Massachusetts. And that August, this sea serpent appears in the bay, and it's like, by different estimations, maybe 20 feet long, maybe 100 feet long. Somebody describes it as the sort of the diameter of a barrel. And it, again, it's not like, you know, just a couple people saw it from a distance, and I don't know, whether it was the light or whatever. It was like everybody saw this. And over the, you know, it wasn't just one time, too. I mean, people, this thing was floating around the bay for like weeks, and people were coming out from Boston. They were taking the, you know, the, you know, carriages out from Boston to see this thing on a weekend. And so, like, what's crazy to me is that this weird sea serpent had way more documented sightings than, you know, a lot of the more famous cryptids, but it kind of, it just doesn't get the love and the credit that some of these other ones do. And I really, really feel like the Gloucester Sea Serpent, I don't even think it's got a really good nickname, you know, like Nessie, but, you know, it really needs one, because this was a cool, weird thing that a lot of people saw. You know, there were like eyewitness statements. There was signed under penalty of perjury affidavits, you know, trying to figure out exactly what the heck this thing was.
Are they still getting these kinds of reports about this thing?
I don't think so. I think it was pretty localized. You know, basically, so what happens is a bunch of eminent doctors and scientists from, you know, Harvard and Boston are like, well, we got to figure out what this is. So they're trying to figure it out. They take all these statements. They get all these eyewitnesses. They're pretty convinced something is real. And then somebody finds a specimen, this baby sea serpent that they find on the beach. So they recover this 4-foot-long weird looking, it's like a normal looking thing, but it's got, you know, it's like a snake, but it's got these humps, and they're like, well, this is it. This is the baby form of whatever it was. So they give it a name, Scolius anthopicus or something like that. You know, I forget the exact Latin name for it, you know, and they're like, great, we have discovered a new species. And then later on, you know, another biologist comes along and looks at this specimen, which is now stuffed and preserved in the museum. And he's like, you know what, guys, this is not a new species. This is a snake with a bad case of rickets. So they're like, okay, well, these guys got it wrong. It's not, that wasn't the real species. But I'm like, but there's still all these crazy eyewitnesses, you know, so somebody saw something. I mean, a lot of people saw something. I don't know that it has returned to the coast of Massachusetts since, but I'm still really fascinated by this strange thing and what's out there.
And cryptids still fascinate you. Let's get back to them for just a second. Science continues, as you mentioned, to find new species all the time. What's so special about cryptids these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. You know, the people who I know who are you know, hunting for cryptids, you can talk to them about these things as animals, but they strike me as that, you know, they're looking for something more than just, you know, a kind of new discovery. Because, I mean, honestly, we, you know, we're still discovering new creatures every day, right? You know, people out in the field, they're making new discoveries, and some of them are, you know, just like tiny insects or something like that. But there's still, you know, sea creatures that are down in the bottom of the ocean that we're discovering, and we're getting on camera for the first time. So that's happening. You know, there was a new primate discovered in Africa not too long ago. I think within the last 20 years, they discovered a primate that they just didn't know was there before. And so that's a big part of it. But it feels like a cryptid, you know, be it the Loch Ness Monster or the Jersey Devil or something like that, you know, it's got to be something special. It's sort of like it's like they're looking for something to prove an exception to the rule, you know, something that is more than just an animal, something that is sort of mythical or fantastical or, you know, just a little bit pushing the edges of what, you know, scientists might, you know, put in their taxonomies, put in their, you know, the kingdom, phylum, order, genus, however that goes. I always forget how that goes. But, you know, that a cryptid has to be kind of outside of that rubric in some ways. And I think that's what's really, again, one of the things that keeps drawing us back to them, because we want to believe that there's something that's just really just be just beyond our grasp, just beyond our reach. I think that's what is people's real fascination is, or at least that's my fascination.
What do you think, Colin, of cryptid hunters?
I mean, I think it's cool. You know, I spent some time, I went to Darien, Georgia, looking for Alti, who is a water beast who hangs out at the mouth of the river there. And, you know, I love the idea of just kind of having to be out in nature in that way. You know, it's sort of like, it's like you're going fishing or hunting, but you have to have this kind of extra sixth sense because you're looking for something that is, you know, is really impossible, you know. You know, it's like, you know, for my last book, I did a lot of ghost hunts, and I love going into these kind of old houses and the way you kind of interact with a, you know, with an old mansion or a prison or something like that, where you kind of, you have to be tuned to the architecture, to the walls, to the floors. You have to kind of listen to everything in a totally different way. And you know, I think like with cryptid hunting, it's like ghost hunting, but you're not in a house. You're out in the woods, or you're, you know, out on the lake or something. It's the same thing. You're trying to train yourself to kind of think and listen in a totally different way. And I think I dare say it's almost a little meditative, you know? You know, it's just kind of to kind of put yourself in that space.
When did this interest in cryptids really begin to pop?
So, right. So, you know, the Gloucester Sea Serpent is the 1820s. And back then they were still cataloging stuff left and right. And they figured, well, you know, we'll figure out what this thing is. And again, I mean, they, you know, back then people thought that panda bears were mythical creatures. You know, they didn't have, you know, documented proof of panda bears until like the late 19th century. So, you know, gradually, the things that used to kind of linger at the edge of the map in, you know, medieval maps, you know, here there'd be monsters, you know, the kind of weird creatures that people just assume were out there. They all either got debunked or they got, you know, properly cataloged as, you know, a giant squid or a, you know, some sort of, you know, known creature. And it's really sort of, you know, we start to get really into cryptids in the 20th century as that work, you know, quote unquote, sort of feels done and finished. And people are like, well, what about this other stuff? And I, you know, what I found, particularly with like Bigfoot, you know, which I mean, there are sightings of Bigfoot that go back, you know, centuries, but it becomes a real kind of pop culture obsession in the 1940s and into the 1950s. And it seems like you've got a group of guys, you know, coming back from the war, coming back from World War II. And they've done this big heroic work, and now they're stuck at desk jobs, and they're trying to kind of reintegrate back into their lives. And that's when they start, you know, those adventure magazine stories, you know, the weasels ate my face kind of, you know, stuff. And that's, they start, you know, kind of reading that stuff, and they get really nostalgic, I think, for that kind of heroic adventure, you know, kind of style that maybe they've left behind. And that's right around the time that Bigfoot becomes a real obsession. And I think it has to do with that kind of, you know, kind of post-war landscape where people are coming back into a kind of civilized normal life, and they start kind of yearning for something a little bit more kind of rugged and chaotic.
You talk about the actor Jimmy Stewart, one of my faves, that he was interested in cryptids.
Well, right, yeah. Like, I'm knee-deep in research for this book, and all of a sudden I come across this crazy reference to Jimmy Stewart, and I was like, what? So, right, okay, so there's a monastery in the Himalayas that supposedly has a hand of the Yeti, and these cryptid hunters back in England, they want to get it out. So they basically come up with a dummy hand, an actual human dried hand, which I don't know where they got from, and they send this guy, Philip Byrne, this Irish guy, to basically go and do the switch. He goes to this monastery, gets the guy who's in charge of watching the Yeti hand, he gets him drunk, and he's able to make the switch. So now he's got this contraband Yeti hand that he has to get out of Tibet. And, you know, he gets into India fine, you know, so he's in India, but Indian customs is really tight. And he's like, you know, there's no way I'm going to get this hand out of Calcutta. And so, you know, Tom Slick, who is his financier, he says, okay, go to the Calcutta Hotel and meet with Jimmy Stewart. And sure enough, Jimmy Stewart, the actor, and his wife were there, and they agree to smuggle out this Yeti hand back to England because they sort of believe that, you know, I don't know, they're famous celebrities. Nobody's going to go through their stuff. And so Jimmy Stewart's wife puts this Yeti hand in her lingerie case And, you know, they fly back, go through customs, no big deal. Then they get home, and she realizes that the lingerie case is missing, right? It's not in her luggage. And they're like, oh, crap, gig is up. They got us. Next day, you know, the airline representatives show up. Like, we're so sorry. Well, this got misplaced. We, you know, here it is. And she's like, did you open it? I'm like, well, we would never open the possessions of a lady or whatever. So that's, it was through Jimmy Stewart that they got this Yeti hand smuggled out of India back into England. Of course, when they did the DNA, turns out to be human, you know, so maybe it was only a Yeti hand while it was in the Himalayas.
Now, UFOs, of course, have fascinated all of us, Colin, for years and years and years. You look at the Kenneth Arnold case that was probably one of the first modern era UFO sightings that kind of kicked this stuff off before Roswell happened, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're really close together, but yeah, it's a week or two before Roswell. Kenneth Arnold, he's out flying near Mount Rainier in Washington, and he sees they're wing-shaped objects. It's really fascinating to me. He describes them as kind of these silver wing-shaped, you know, flying things. But when he describes them to a local news reporter, he says they seem to move like discs skipped across the water. So even though he didn't describe them as discs literally, he used this figure of speech, and then everybody kind of seized on that, and they're like, oh, it's flying discs. But, you know, he didn't actually describe them as flying discs. He described them as flying wings. But yeah, you know, he was an unimpeachable witness. He was a solid stand-up guy. Nobody thought he was crazy. He, you know, had a very meticulous, detailed, factual report. And as such, you know, he thought it might have been, you know, something related to the Russians. And he'd actually, first stop was to go to the FBI to basically say, look, I don't know if I saw some sort of secret military, you know, covert attack or something like that. But the FBI was closed. So he went, next best thing is he went to the newspapers, and they're like, yeah, we'll run that story. That's crazy. So that's how that started.
Tell us about the strange contactee story of a Gloria Lee.
Gloria Lee is one of the saddest stories I came across. So Gloria Lee, you know, she's a flight attendant. She's happily married, and she starts getting a contact from a character on Venus called JW, who begins to tell her all this stuff. And JW, you know, gives her all this information. She writes this book called Why We Are Here. That does pretty well, and she, you know, she builds up a pretty robust, you know, fan base. And you know, one of the things I thought was really interesting is that JW is really pushing free love. Gloria Lee's book really sort of is basically like, you know, monogamy is for the birds. You should be with whoever you want, and who cares if it's multiple people, which is, you know, pretty risque for 1955 or something.
Oh,
like
sure.
That. Yeah. So anyway, JW is also like, you know what, we got to stop nuclear war. We got to stop these atomic bombs. So what you should do is you should take these blueprints that I've given you for my spaceship, and you should take them to Washington D.C., give them to the government, and then with, you know, this new alien technology, we will be able to kind of transcend our war making ways and you know, usher in peace and prosperity around the globe. So she goes to Washington, D.C., and lo and behold, Congress doesn't want to talk to her. So she can't get a meeting with anybody. And so JW says, what you should do is just get a hotel and just go on a hunger strike. And when I'm ready, I will take you up to Venus in an elevator, a kind of, you know, mystical elevator. And so so Gloria Lee goes back to this hotel, and she stops eating. You know, trying to draw attention to her cause, trying to get people to listen to her about UFOs. And 2 months later, her husband gets a frantic phone call from the hotel manager. Your wife hasn't eaten in 2 months, and she's dying.
Oh.
And he calls an ambulance. She dies on the way to the hospital. So,
oh, my,
you know,
God. That is tragic.
Yeah, it's a terrible story. You know, and her publishing company, worried maybe that they've killed the golden goose, continues to put out books after her death. Basically, they're like, well, we channeled her from beyond the grave, and we're proud
right.
to bring a sequel to the book out. So, you know, it's a little morbid way to kind of, you know, cash in on her legacy. But yeah, it's a sad little story.
There have been all kinds of people in the past who have talked about going to Venus and things like that. George Van Tassel. Did you stumble across things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really love that period of our, you know, session with UFOs, you know, before the aliens were, you know, kind of, you know, the kind of weird triangle shapes with the thin bodies and the long arms, when they were just kind of had the, you know, flowing locks and the silver jumpsuits, and they would, you know, come and they looked an awful lot like humans. And yeah, so George Van Tassel, he's one of those. There's a whole bunch of those. Truman Befferum is another guy I really liked who met this Venusian who basically is the opposite of Gloria Lee. His Venusian told him that, you need to be faithful in marriage and monogamous, and that was the only way to true happiness. So they seem to be putting a lot of words in these Venusians' mouths.
Did you ever come across the name of Valiant Thor?
Yeah.
He was from Venus and came here to talk to us about bettering our world, and apparently nobody wanted to talk to him.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. A lot of these guys, these contactees, they were pretty single-mindedly focused on nuclear war. That was a big, you know, a lot of these contactees are like, well, you know, they told us that we had to stop nuclear weapons, and it was usually that plus one other kind of hobby for us. With Gloria Lee, it was free love or whatever. So everybody kind of, you know, but there was that kind of that real kind of frantic obsession, I think, with trying to figure out, you know, like, can we are there aliens out there who are trying to, get us to stop us from killing us?
Some of them do care. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you, Colin, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.